On this episode of Still Loading, Video Game History Preservation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of Still Loading. I'm actually going to try to keep the show going weekly for the time being, at least until my kid gets here. So for now, I'm doing my best, but we have another episode, another week in a row. And this week, we are talking about a topic that is near and dear to my heart. And when I say we, returning guest, who was just on a couple weeks ago, actually, Dexter Morrill is on the podcast. Dexter, how are you doing?
Hey, doing great. Thank you for having me back.
Thank you for coming back. So I had you on today because one of the things that we kind of got to, when we were getting to know each other when we recorded the first time, we both kind of, I guess, bonded over it. But, you know, we got to know each other with, we both enjoy this topic, is video game history and video game preservation. And obviously video game history because your last time we were on, we were talking about your Kickstarter for a children's video game history book. And this time we're going to be talking about the topic of video game preservation. And you wrote a term paper on this, correct?
Yes. I'm still waiting for my grad school to come knocking on my door and telling me it's not real, that you can't actually get a master's degree writing a thesis about video game history preservation. But it went well, so I passed, and yeah, that's what I did my thesis on. I went to school for art and design, but I wanted to find a way to bring that, you know, that passion, what my passions together of comics and video games, and it seemed perfect fit, and kind of fell down a rabbit hole.
What was the reaction by your professors who read it? Like, I mean, obviously you passed, but were they surprised by the topic, or were they intrigued by it?
I think most of the initial reactions I got were like, okay, like, sure. They you know, it seemed very kind of obscure or like really niche to them. Mm-hmm. But the more I got into it and the more they, you know, understood, the more appreciation I felt like they gained. I remember one of my professors actually telling me, like, this is a big deal. You know, I can see more people talking about this in the future. And, mm-hmm. you know, so I definitely won over a few of my professors that helped me out.
That's good. I mean, I would say that means you did a good job on your paper if your paper was able to win over anybody, especially probably professors who probably don't give as much credence to video games as people our age. I mean, depending on how old your professors are, of course.
Right.
So let's kind of go into what the idea or the concept of game preservation is. Video game history preservation is just what you see and is similar to what you see in like film preservation or book preservation or history in general. Like, you are trying to save the documents and future-proof them for all intents and purposes, future-proof them so future generations can see what this medium is and was and how it came to be and what the mechanics and parts of it are, other than just the games themselves. Well, like, the Video Game History Foundation does a lot is like the source code, the original file that, you know, was flashed to all the cartridges or copied to all the discs, like all that good stuff. Do you have anything to add to that concept? I feel like I covered it, but I wonder if I'm missing anything that you think that could be added in there.
No, I mean, that sounds about right. I mean, you know, any kind of history that, you know, because we've all had to write term papers or do research of some kind, and we have to dig into some form of history for some thing at some point in time. And, you know, the same goes for video games, except where video games gets tricky is the gameplay and interactivity of it is where it gets really interesting and difficult. Whereas, you know, there's limited points of interactivity for pretty much anything else. You know, film, you watch it. You know, music, you listen to it. And other than kind of knowing where and when those things came from, it's pretty easy to experience those things and have relatively the same experience every time.
Yeah.
But video games, you know, it's very different from what system you're playing it on to what screen you're looking at to, you know, what direction you go in a level. Like, there's so many more variables involved with, like, what constitutes preserving a video game.
That is some good points to bring up. I didn't even think, I mean, I feel like I should have, but I didn't even think about the interactive nature of the medium is the fact that how do you preserve something that is different from person to person, that is wholly unique to each individual's experience with the game, with each game they play. And there's a couple ways I'm thinking about off the top of my head that people can preserve that or the best they can. But before we get into that, one of the questions a lot of people would probably ask when we go on this is, why should anyone care? So, Dexter, why should people care about video game history, and why should they care about video game preservation?
Because I love it. No.
Same.
People should care because I will share the tidbit of information that kind of shocked me into being so invested in video game preservation. And that would have to be the Frank Cifaldi presentation at GDC in 2016, spring of 2016, the Game Developers Conference. Frank Cifaldi, who is a video game historian, had a presentation, should be on YouTube if anyone's interested in checking it out.
I believe it is, yeah.
It's called, his segment's actually called It's Just Emulation, and he goes all the way into it. But specifically, the thing that terrified me was he talked about how the film industry, the first 40 years of the existence of film, 80% of that is lost because there was no concept of preserving it for history. There was no, you know, no one ever considered it. You know, kind of same thing video games went through. Like, is it even art? You know, they went through the same thing. And
that argument's still being had, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So think about that. The first 40 years of film, 80% of that, we'll never know what it was. We'll never be able to experience that. Well, if you look at video game history and kind of, you know, if you're starting with Pong kind of era, we're in that 40-year range right now for video games. And we are also, you know, staring that same fate in the face that film went through. But we have the opportunity to kind of learn from that. And so hearing Frank Cifaldi kind of phrase it that way, I felt like I needed to, you know, join in the fight, you know, of preserving video games. You know, everybody loves movies, you know, and so like kind of thinking about, oh, that's so sad. You know, if you love movies, it's really sad that we lost that history.
Yeah.
Now let's apply that to this very much new art form of video games, and like how sad that will be for a, you know, generations in the future looking back.
And even think about, I mean, one thing we do have an advantage on compared to film is that a lot of the media that we have for games is still around. The vast majority of it is still around because we have physical cartridges, we have physical discs, we have all that media. Now, what we don't have is a lot of the more contextual stuff and a lot of like the really, really early stuff. Like, how do you preserve Space Wars? You know, what's considered, which is considered to be, I think that's still considered to be the first quote unquote video game.
Right.
For those who don't know, Space Wars was pretty much just like a dueling spaceship shooter game on a giant mainframe at MIT in the 60s. Like, I think 68? I don't know if I'm getting that right at all.
That sounds
But I know it was in the 60s. I just don't know if I got the year right. And it was on a CRT and everything, which is crazy, especially for computers back then. But you know, how do you really preserve that? I think that computer still is around. I think they actually have preserved the computer itself, but mm-hmm. I don't know. But yeah, so that it's a good point to bring up. The other thing I would say is one of the reasons it's important to preserve is that games are an important medium and they're not going anywhere. The right. fact that they have, what is it, the Video Game History Foundation run by Frank Cifaldi. We're going to be referencing Frank Cifaldi a lot in this video, by the way. And we're going to be probably mention some points that he has made before on a lot of his various speeches and conferences and stuff. So if you hear any overlap, it's not intentional. It's just, you know, we've retained that, we've absorbed that information from him, and also hopefully we'll add something to it. But they mention on it, on their website, that if you look at what the revenue is for video games, the video games hold 55% market share of all media combined. People spend 55% more. I had that right. 55% of the market. 7% is in music, and then another 38% is film and TV. But video games outperforms both of them combined, which is just crazy. I wonder where books would factor in, but I don't think it would quite edge over as much as I would like it to, as even as someone who doesn't read as often as they should. So it is important to preserve video game history, because it's no longer this fad that everyone thought it was during the crash of 83. It's something that's here to stay, and it shows because of how much people spend on it. So that is why at least we think you should care. And I think especially the fact that it's left such a big cultural footprint over the last 30, 40 years, that it's rapidly becoming something like film, where games have emotional impacts on people. It has emotional impacts on culture. I mean, you even think about, look at court cases in the 90s to early to mid 2000s. You had the Mortal Kombat court cases, and with Night Trap and everything in the 90s that, you know, established the ESRB. And then you had a lot of court cases in the wake of Columbine and all these horrific tragedies that people blamed video games on. If something's not making a cultural impact, no one would think to blame it. Now, granted, video games, it was not their fault, but if it wasn't making some type of an impact, no one would think twice about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's kind of a screwed up bar to think about. Like, if you can be blamed for a tragic event, you might be relevant. It's maybe that's not the best bar that we want to advertise video games for. But now there are many different types of preservation. Dexter, could you list off some of those? What are the different types of preservation that are currently being done? And maybe there's more we don't even know just yet.
Yeah, I would say that you could kind of boil it down that there's two major columns. There's a third one that we'll kind of talk about, but the two major columns that people think of and that are usually utilized are physical preservation and digital preservation.
Mm-hmm.
Physical is exactly what you would imagine it is, you know, preserving the hardware, the consoles, preserving the software, all the cartridges or discs or things of that nature. And obviously there's going to be pros and cons to either of them. Obviously the pros to physical preservation is you have the actual artifact. You can use the actual controllers. So talking about how preserving the experience, you know, like you're not necessarily using a keyboard or whatever, you're actually using what was intended to be used. The con to that is these things were not really built to last forever. They were built as, you know,
I'd take issue with the NES. That thing's a tank.
It absolutely is. But even with like the scariest thing is bit rot is a real thing.
Yes.
As well. So,
yes, it is.
So these, if anyone is familiar with like video game collecting, these insane prices that games are going for sealed, and they're being graded for their how well they're sealed. But you know, you can have them sealed all you want, but if someone opens up that game in 100 years, bit rot, you know, that game is going to be a brick of plastic, you know, and that kind of thing. Yep. Same thing with DVDs and discs and stuff. Those things are going to be useless.
I would argue, though, that at least with DVDs and so on, that's going to last a lot longer than CDs are. But you are correct. Data rot, bit rot, it's going to happen at some point.
Right.
Most likely, like, I want to say PS2 and on, it's probably not going to happen in our lifetime. But, like, PS1 and earlier, it's probably going to happen at some point. I mean, it's not guaranteed. I mean, I think just now, like, the CDs from the early 80s are finally starting to, like, wear away. But yeah. Also, those were, like, super primitive pressings, and they weren't, they were relatively new. So if you have, like, crappy pressings, like, any burned CD is pretty much, like, even burned CDs from 10 years ago are pretty much dead. Their data rot has already taken. I have a bunch. I burned so many music CDs and mix CDs for myself and girlfriends. And but all of them are probably no longer good because those are not quality. They weren't pressed with quality materials, I guess, or they weren't done in as quality of a way as professionally a way as something, say, a PS1 game or a DV or a PS2 game. Even a Sega CD game, though, those don't have the best quality either.
Yeah, no, the other thing about the physical preservation or like playing it the way it was intended, I'm trying to remember, I just saw on Twitter recently that someone found out going back and playing one of the old Mega Man games on NES that there's a stage where there's stars in the background. You're running and you're running by stars.
Mm-hmm.
And on a CRT television, which is all any of us had when those games were out, the stars blink like red, blue, white, like as you're running across the television. It's like utilizing that. But if you emulate it on modern televisions, they're just white stars.
Like, really?
So
I did not know that part. I knew there was some issues with graphical fidelity and what the original intention of the machines were for, but I never knew it was something that blatant. I know about Sonic the Hedgehog and the waterfall effect is also a common one with that too. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you'll run into things like that. I guess that's kind of digging into the digital side, so switching over to that column of digital preservation. There seems to be a lot more pros with digital preservation in the sense that, you know, yeah, bit rot can happen. All of these things can happen. But as long as you keep, you know, the code around and you're putting it on to different, you know, copying it to different newer technology, it's going to keep showing up. We're going to have that kind of source code left around. But then the cons get into like what we were just saying with the Mega Man game. If that person hadn't noticed that, like, that's something that might have been lost to time. Like, wait, these stars are colors? Like, or,
yeah,
you know, and that may sound like a small thing, but, you know, all of these little things will add up eventually.
To an incomplete picture of what games used to be. Because if you, like, that's just one aspect. But if you take all the, like you said, a bunch of those tiny aspects spanning across multiple games, spanning across multiple consoles, you're going to get a very warped view of what video games were like way back when. I would even say, though, in digital preservation, one of the benefits it's been kind of experiencing, I don't want to say a renaissance, but a renaissance, because it's not like it's a rebirth, but it is a renaissance in the sense of like the FPGA processors that have become very popular. I can't afford their consoles at all. You know what I'm analog.
Mm-hmm.
There. So for those who don't know what an FPGA is, it's a type of processor. It's just think of it like a CPU for all intents and purposes. And what's cool about it is that it can emulate other bits of hardware. So normally when you have an emulator, what an emulator does is that it's a program. It's a digital program, you know, ones and zeros that say, this is how a Nintendo is supposed to work. This is how a Super Nintendo is supposed to work. And it mimics it to the best of its ability. And then you put a ROM into that thing and it reads the ROM and it tries to read the ROM as the original Nintendo, the original Sega, the original Super Nintendo, Atari, what have you. it tries to read that ROM the way the original hardware did and tries to execute that ROM in the way the original hardware did. But that's all done using someone's programming know-how. They're programming a computer program to pretend to be a physical piece of hardware, a digital program pretending to be a physical piece of hardware. What an FPGA processor does is that it is a physical piece of hardware that pretends to be a different physical piece of hardware. You can literally program it essentially using, I think it's logic gates, but essentially just taking that processor and then looking at another console and be like, okay, this console has this number of logic gates at these positions and blah, blah, blah. Now I'm not a tech guy, so I don't know the specifics other than that, but it'll look at how the original hardware on a physical level operated, and then it'll take all that and plug it into the FPGA. And now the FPGA is probably the closest emulation you can get to original hardware. It's practically one-to-one from my understanding, and you don't lose that physical part. You don't lose that physical emulation, or you don't lose that anything from the digital emulation anymore. And what's cool about that is that you can now output that to anything. A lot of them are going to HDMI, so that way you can play your NES games and Super Nintendo games and Atari games. I don't think Analog has an Atari thing for it, but theoretically it could. And you can play them in HD on your HDTV in beautiful high definition. But you could, technically, they could set that up with anything. They could output it to an analog signal if they really wanted to.
Right. Yeah. No. Absolutely. They are definitely methods being, and the great thing about analog and what they're doing is it's combining both columns that we talked about. It's combining physical and digital preservation. They're using the digital preservation and now creating a new physical thing to kind of help bring that back in, talking about how bit rot and things like that, and how just the old parts in general, they're not making those anymore. You know, those are obsolete. So kind of repackaging them into a new physical item at that point. So I like that attack, that, you know, that mindset of combining those two. I think that's a great aspect, and that's something that should continue for sure.
And with, I think what's impressive to me is that it's hardware emulation, not software emulation. When that was first described to me, my immediately thought was, what do you mean? And then once I understood that it's a physical piece of hardware that's pretending to be something else, like it's programmed using machine language, assembly language essentially, to behave like a completely different machine. And it's such a malleable processor that you can go on to, I think, even like they're doing this, they've expanded it beyond just consoles, where I think the MAME project, which is like the arcade emulation software.
Hey everyone, I just wanted to jump in here real quick because I made a small mistake here. The project that I'm talking about here, I said it's from MAME. It is actually called the Mister Project. MAME is digital arcade emulation, or it's just software arcade emulation. And the Mister Project is hardware arcade emulation. I mentioned before about the FPGAs and how they can emulate console hardware. Well, Mister does that for arcade boards, and you'll kind of hear a little bit more in this next segment. So yeah, just want to jump in and make that correction quick.
They're creating FPGAs for arcade boards because, once again, you're never, like, digital emulation, software emulation is never going to be one-to-one. It's just too difficult, not anytime soon, I should say. It's just so difficult to create that one-to-one experience, and especially with arcade cabinets. How do you recreate the arcade experience? That's something that's so different from home consoles, because there's only so much you can do with that, because half of the arcade experience is not the game.
Yeah. You have to think about how, you know, the design mindset of the people making these games, you know, they were considering the cabinets that housed them, and like the types of controllers, like the little trackballs, or, you know, the different types of interaction were all part of it. You know, that was part of the attraction of getting someone to put the quarter in the machine. It's like, oh, what does it look like? You know?
And some of these arcade cabinets were designed for specific experiences that you literally cannot emulate even on a console. Even the home ports, like perfect example, like if you look at any racing game, racing games in arcade, you can't emulate that experience on the home console. You can kind of try with the plug-in, like with the plug-in like steering wheels and gas pedals and stuff like that. But then that means you have to buy a bunch of attachments. Like it's not something that's – it doesn't have – It has a pretty high barrier to entry for that experience on a home console. Or games like I'm trying to think of another example. Like look at stuff like now where it's like the newer arcade games that are like Jurassic Park and House of the Dead and stuff like that. Like those are that's very hard to emulate on a home console. It's done very differently. And even just, I don't know, like you said, the design of the arcade cabinet, like there's a whole aesthetic that goes along with it other than just the actual playing of the game. And we've been kind of circling around these two pillars of types of preservation, because that's what started us down this rabbit hole of FPGAs and emulation and all this stuff, is physical and digital preservation. Physical, like you said before, is, I'm just kind of recapping, is, you know, collecting the hardware, collecting the cartridges, the discs, the hardware, the maybe even a tube TV if you want to play it on that, like trying to find ways to get a physical representations or the original physical copies of everything that was there. And then digital preservation is used to help, especially with what, like you mentioned before, bit rot and data rot, like it's meant to rip all those cartridges off and find a way to permanently preserve them. But the downfall of digital preservation is that you lose a lot of the context and you lose a lot of the experience. Hence, like you said before, the Mega Man thing with the twinkling stars, and I mentioned with the Sonic, and then also the arcade experience. Mm-hmm. And they've made steps. FPGAs are great emulators. And I still think the FPGA thing, specifically with the arcades, is such a cool thing. There's an episode of Retronauts where they interviewed one of the guys who's been working with FPGAs. I think his name is Smoke Monster. I don't know what his real name is, but his online handle, Smoke Monster. And he talks about having to bypass the crazy security systems on old arcade boards to avoid tampering. And then they have to, once they can bypass it, then they can analyze it and create an FPGA for that arcade board. And they'll throw it up on this website, and you can then download the schematic for that FPGA board for whichever arcade game you want. So you, if you wanted to, you could buy like an FPGA core. I don't think they're even that expensive, but you buy an FPGA core, and then you can be like, all right, I want to go find OutRun. I want to find an arcade. I want to find an FPGA port, for lack of a better term, of the OutRun arcade board. And then you can download that and set up your FPGA to behave like the OutRun board. You just have to put the file on for the FPGA to read, and it'll act like the game, which is crazy.
Right. Yeah, that would make it so much more accessible, and that kind of deviates into another branch a little bit. I don't know if we want to touch on it at all, is talking about another reason why preservation is so difficult for video games, is that emulation has become like this dirty word in the industry. Mm-hmm. That, you know, like especially the big corporations, they just see emulation. Oh, you're emulating our stuff. That means that you're copying it. That means that you're stealing it. And, you know, in some respects, yes, it is a tool for piracy. But in the sense of archiving, in the sense of preserving, it's also a huge, really helpful, cheap, easy tool to utilize. But because of that it's become kind of synonymous with piracy, there are so many businesses that are just very like, no, we're not even going to touch emulation, and we don't want to deal with that. And so now, where we have, going back to film, music, stuff like that, music, you've got Spotify, you've got, you know, you've got Pandora, you've got all of these ways that you can listen to music. Television and movies, you know, I don't even think I need to even spell that out. Netflix, you've got all the streaming services.
You can download movies easily still. Like, there's so many different ways that you can either buy or quote unquote rent them by streaming them.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so much more complicated for video games. And all of that red tape makes it extremely difficult to preserve. So kind of going down that branch a little bit, that's something else that really kind of puts a huge wall in front of historians, you know, that they can be kind of viewed as, for some reason, they're viewed as pirates because they want to do emulation. In that same, I believe it's that same talk with Frank Cifaldi, bringing him up as the pretty much the godfather of game preservation.
He pretty much is the foremost expert in this field.
He was one of the lead people in doing the Mega Man collections that came out on all the different platforms.
He works for Digital Eclipse, I believe, and they do a lot. Like, they did the Disney Afternoon collection, which was the NES games, but on modern consoles. But yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you're fine. He ended up talking about how they went to Capcom and they talked about emulating those games, and they could do that in 2 seconds. That would be so cheap, so easy. And Capcom was like, we'd rather not use emulation to do these. So they literally had to build from scratch an emulation, basically like their own emulation, to put these games out, which cost them more time, more money, all of this. He did mention that the bright side of it was they were able to add features that they wouldn't have if they had just gone the cheap, quick route. So they were able to do like some of the rewinding features. They did some like some time trial modes that they are able to mess with that they wouldn't have been able to do if they hadn't built it from scratch. But he mentioned how like it would have been the production and significantly like a fraction of the time, you know. But Capcom was just afraid of the E word, you know, they didn't want to even deal with that. So they had to do this completely from scratch.
It's so wild to me because it's, if you're working with the company, it's not a dirty word anymore. Like, the company sanctioned the, like, what, and what do you think that when Nintendo throws things up on, when they threw up stuff on their eShop and the Wii U eShop and the 3DS eShop and on Netflix and all the other different stuff they have on the Switch, they're just emulated versions of the game. They're not completely redone ports. They are emulation. They're emulated. And there's a lot of gripes with some of those emulations, to be fair. Specifically, the Wii U versions are not very good because it's, you know, I remember when before the Wii died, I remember a lot of people were talking about, like, if you bought stuff on the Wii shop and didn't transfer it over the Wii U, don't, because the Wii was capable of native 480i, like analog video. And that was a lot more compatible than the HD video that we got from the Wii U. So when you have old games on that, the up-res wasn't very great. There was like a weird, it was weirdly dark. It wasn't nearly as bright as it should have been. It wasn't nearly as bright as it was on the NES. There's a lot of weird stuff like that. So even when companies do their own preservation, their own emulation, it's not always the greatest. But it's just so weird to me that Capcom just would be so mad about it when you could literally emulate Wii.
Right.
I don't understand that. But no, you're 100% right. Emulation is a dirty word in the industry. Just look at a couple of years ago, what EMU Paradise got shut down by, got a cease and desist from Nintendo and one other ROM, well-known ROM website. I forget what it was, but Game Dave did a video about it. Our mutual friend Game Dave did a video about it.
Yes, he did.
And yeah, it's a dirty word, but I think Frank Cifaldi famously jokes, but not really joking. He's joking, but not really joking, of steal from your bosses, steal from your work. And that's like his like desperate plea to video game developers, steal from your work. And stuff like that happens. I've actually, like, one of the things I want to start doing on this podcast, and I've reached out to one person already, but he works for the Video Game Foundation, or at least works at Digital Eclipse. I'm not going to say his name yet, not because it's like anything bad. It's just I haven't confirmed a date, so I don't want to throw it out there and then it not happen type of thing. But I want to get more developers on my podcast to kind of go into, to do my part as much as I possibly can, video game preservation, video game history preservation, because a large part of that is not even just like our experiences, it's the developers' experiences making the game. Even if you take out the source code and you take out any weird legal stuff that happened surrounding a game, you still have the stories of the developers that made it. I had him on the podcast before, Patrick Hickey Jr. He's an author, and he has a series. He has a series of books called The Minds Behind the Games, and so far, I believe there's three out. There's The Minds Behind the Games, The Minds Behind the Adventure Games, and he just came out with The Minds Behind the Sports Games. And then he's going to come out with Sega Genesis and PlayStation and shooter games and all this other stuff, so breaking it down to individual genres. But he interviews developers who worked on famous titles. And famously, just a quick anecdote with and I might have mentioned in his episode, which was earlier this year, just in terms of stories to add context around the developers, not just the players' experience with the game, when Night Trap was being made, when Night Trap came out, and you had all the legal crap that went on with it, and people blamed it for all this violence, even though it was super campy and not really sexual or violent at all, just to like kind of hinted at it. One of the developers' girlfriends broke up with him because of the news coverage. Like, they actually were fine, but because she found out that he worked on this game, they broke up, which is just crazy to think about. And so that game at one point ruined his life, and not just because of the legal things, but because, well, I mean, it was the legal things, but it wasn't like he was being sued, but because he was associated with it, he lost a girlfriend because of it. That's crazy. And so that's a major part of it. And I think that's a good transition into the third pillar. The third main pillar of video game preservation is contextual preservation. Preserving what the context surrounding the game, whether the context surrounding it being made, context surrounding its release, or the context surrounding its reception. And that also is not limited, but not, including but not limited to the release of the game up to modern day. I mean, how many times do you see YouTubers doing videos about a game from on the NES that at the time maybe got panned, like Earthbound, perfect example. That's a Super Nintendo game, but got panned upon release, and now it's a cult darling. You know, it's a super popular game, super famous in the gaming community as being this fantastically well-made game. And contextual preservation is super important. I think that was one of the main parts of your thesis, right?
Yes. I guess if I can back up a little bit, talking about my thesis, being, you know, like I said, doing an art and design degree, I didn't just write the thesis. I had to also have a deliverable, is what they call it. So I have something to show for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you, I'm not a tech whiz by any means. I'm not a programmer or engineer or anything like that. I was in school for art and design. So, but I still wanted to be able to contribute. I still wanted to be, you know, to help the cause. And my deliverable was I was working on a comic that would describe all of these things, that would talk about all these things, because this can be kind of a hard topic to make relatable to everybody, even folks that aren't involved with video games. And so what better way than a really good story to get people involved? And my concept, and I've got some artwork on my website, I can plug that later, but to show for it. But I was originally writing this story, and the character in my story was pretty much going through the same journey I was going through with my research. But I don't know if you've ever seen, or have you ever seen The NeverEnding Story or read the book?
I've never read the book, but I saw the movie a while ago.
Okay. It was kind of the same format as that, where there's simultaneously stories going on, where there's the boy reading the book, and then there's like the book has its own world that's progressing, and they're kind of interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. I conceived this story called The Fate of Owari, was the name of my comic, where there's this prototype game. It's one of a kind. It was never published. And these two young teenage girls find the game and they decide to play it. And meanwhile, inside the game, because the game is so old, the world inside is starting to, like, rot from bit rot and everything, and starting to delete and erase. Even the main character in the game is erased.
It sounds awesome.
And the character that is like an NPC that you go to save the game is the only one left now that can actually save the game. So he's now traveling the world as it's erasing, trying to find a way to preserve it, while these girls are trying to play the game and preserve it as well. They're learning, like, oh, something's wrong with the game. So there's these simultaneous stories going on where there's the characters in the game that are kind of metaphorically trying to save it. So they're like trying to replace the battery in the cartridge. That's what the girls are doing. Meanwhile, inside the game, there's like this power source in Mount Lithium, you know, like,
yeah.
So it's like the metaphor going on. And they go through all these different methods of preservation, physical and digital. And I was kind of simultaneously writing this story as I was doing the research, similar to my characters in my story. And I was realizing that I wasn't getting a happy ending with my research because of how many, like, pros and cons, like, to every form of preservation, I was finding, you know, some big cons with them. And then, like you said, contextual preservation, I came across, like, oh, this is it. And discovered that, spoilers to a comic that I don't know if I'll ever finish. since this character is the NPC that saves the game, he's got a journal that he's been keeping the entire time during his adventures. And that's the key to saving his game, is the contextual preservation.
Is the journey and the friends he made along the way.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a great idea, though. I legitimately was captivated just listening to that synopsis of it. I hope you do finish it. That'd be cool.
They're very limited. I think I've got like 6 or 7 left. I had to actually make them myself. I actually made a physical version of the little story. It's not the full thing. It's just like a little prologue. I formatted it like an NES instruction manual.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so it looks like, cause I always loved the story in the Legend of Zelda manual, how it had the little storybook portion to it. So that's how it's formatted. And I had to actually, collate it and build it and print it and staple it all together myself, because when I was trying to find a way to print it and have it assembled, I found out that back when NES manuals were being made, there were no specs. There were no, like, every company that made their own game had to figure it out. They had to figure out how to make their instruction manuals.
Wow, that's weird.
And all they knew is it had to fit in the box and what Nintendo would do with theirs. So I had to actually, like, do what the companies did with their manuals, look up, okay, what size did Nintendo usually do to fit in the box, and format it myself. And then I had to actually, like, staple it by hand and everything.
That's so weird that Nintendo wouldn't provide those specs for their third-party developers to make so much for their seal of quality. I mean, come on, man. The seal of quality was slapped on every single box, but they wouldn't even give their developer or give third party developers like some uniform measurements. That's crazy. Yeah.
They might have given it, like, they never gave them any templates or like, hey, go to this printer and they'll make it for you kind of thing. Like,
once again, adding to contextual preservation of game history, that's something there's a lot of context with that. That explains why a lot of, like, manuals probably weren't uniform size. I don't know how many off the top of my head mine are. Like, I have mine are all back there, but I don't know. I'd have to look through each of them to see, like, what's the manual size. To be fair, some of them, even Nintendo ones, weren't all uniform. Like, if you look at, like, Super Mario Bros. 3, it's kind of that standard small leaflet. But if you go to NES Open Tournament Golf, it's like a textbook. It's not that thick, but it's the size of the box. It's not some small leaflet. It's the full size of the box. which is crazy to think. That's so weird. Yeah, so contextual preservation, there's a lot of ways that can be done that can, contextual preservation can be achieved in a lot of various ways besides just like if you just have a game, if you have a physical copy of the game, you're not preserving anything but that game. You're not preserving anything but your experience with that game. So ways to add contextual preservation, honestly, YouTube does a huge chunk of it.
Yeah.
Between all the gaming creators, there's tons of that, but also looking at old magazines. In fact, we were talking off mic. Let me see if I still have it here. I do. We were talking off mic about like old game magazines. I have a bunch of old ones that I'm trying to find a organization to donate them to, because as much as I love them, I don't really have much else to do with them. It's not like I read them very often. And I have a large run of Game Informer from the last 10 years, with the exception of a handful in 2019, because my mom accidentally, we share the GameStop account because it's easier for everyone to get points. And she got confused and turned off the physical magazine. So I got digital for probably half a year. So I got a handful that GameStop just gave me for free even before I switched back over, but I'm missing some from the more recent run. But looking through it, I literally opened to a random page from an April 2010 Game Informer, and just kind of adding to the context of stuff at the time, like this magazine, just so people know, it had a review, or it had a prequel for Sonic the Hedgehog 4 Episode 1, which was that mobile game. Alan Wake, Portal 2 was the cover on this one. But one of the craziest things, let me see if I can find it again, they had an interview with PopCap founder. That's kind of crazy. That's kind of cool, actually. Let me see if I can find it again real quick. Hold on. Da-da-da. Here it is. Oh, now I feel stupid. So that thing that we were talking about, it was a parody. It says parody at the bottom.
Well, they called it, though.
They did. That's kind of crazy. So I thought this thing was legit, the Nintendo announces, but this is a parody. A closer look at the Nintendo Weeds, and it was the Wii DS. And it says, last month, Nintendo revealed that, and this is just, you know, pretty much the Onion, but for Game Informer, this one little segment. And it was last month, it says that, once again, this is all not real. Just clarify, don't want anyone thinking this is like some weird unknown news from the 2010s. But it, surprisingly enough, 7 years prior to the Switch coming out, kind of predicted the Switch. It goes, last month, Nintendo revealed that its surprise hardware announcement was not an HD Wii, as many had speculated, but instead a hybrid of handheld and console gaming, the Wii DS, pronounced Weeds. After some hands-on time with the system, we break down all key improvements and features. And then in the specs, it says visuals. Graphics will look the same as those on the Wii and the DS, which are already basically indistinguishable. Throwing some shade at the Wii there, saying the graphics were shitty. But yeah, no, that's kind of funny. But
little did they know, Nintendo was listening.
It didn't quite have the contextual preservation that I was hoping for, but it is. But it's kind of funny I guess it kind of does, because that's a parody, right? So it was them making fun of Nintendo in 2010, trying to say that they were going to make a hybrid handheld home console. And, well, Nintendo did do that, and it worked out pretty well. Though there is some weird stuff in here. Like, there's a review. Well, there's a review. It says, I don't know what game this is for. It just says EA and Visceral present Gatsby. And then it looks like, is this all just parody shit? Oh, this is literally all parody shit
for the April issue. Yeah,
this is all parody shit. Mass Effect has, like, instead of Commander, it was Mass Effect 3, and instead of Commander Shepard, it just had Kratos's head on there. then it had Left 4 Dead 3, of course, once again making fun of Valve's inability to make any third trilogy. Game. That's crazy. So yeah, there's a whole parody section in this, which is crazy. But it is important, though, to get back to the topic. It is important, like, magazines do provide context. By reading reviews within magazines, you get an idea of what people felt at the time. And Retronauts harps on this a lot. Like, don't give too much credence to reviews, because reviews are written in a very specific place and time from a very specific person's point of view. And right. While that person has played a lot of games and is an expert, quote unquote, and I'm not using quote the quote unquote thing as to be dismissive of reviewers, but they are, I mean, they are an expert. They play a lot of different games. And so that viewpoint is very specific to obviously them. If you look back at the Earthbound, once again, got panned critically and commercially. Actually, it's sold okay commercially, but got panned critically and now it's considered a critical darling. So it's weird how some games don't do well upon release, just how some movies don't do well on the release. I'm a huge Kevin Smith fan. That's 90% of his catalog. It doesn't do well on release. I'm a huge Mallrats fan. Does not do well on release. Did not do well on release.
You have to think about marketing too, and that's also good in magazines, seeing how games are marketed. Yes. Speaking of Earthbound, the whole, like, I know for me, seeing promo stuff for Earthbound as a kid, the ad, this game stinks, you know, it was because there was scratch and sniff stickers.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't help.
What a weird
thing that
marketing
actually got
idea.
Me interested in Earthbound, though, was the little 3D models that they had, the little clay models that they would use.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. But the marketing, because at that time was Nintendo was trying to be Sega and trying to be edgy.
Mm-hmm.
But totally missed the mark in selling what Earthbound was. So I think that affected me. I didn't discover Earthbound until much later.
I mean, and just thinking of additional contextual preservation, Nintendo had a big marketing thing with Nintendo Power. That's a huge thing of, like, Nintendo from Nintendo's viewpoint, from internally what Nintendo thought of themselves, kind of.
Right.
Granted, it was definitely skewed in their favor because it's a Nintendo magazine, but.
And what makes contextual so important as well, just to use, you know, for folks that, you know, if you're trying to convince someone that's not as much video gamey, just to go back to film, if you were to show someone Citizen Kane, they would be like, this was boring and I don't get it. Like, you know, but if you give them the historical context, like a lot of the cinematography, if you show them Citizen Kane and then other films from that same mm-hmm. time period, they're going to be like, wow, Citizen Kane, like they revolutionized so much. Like, it's all kinds of different cinematography, the storytelling, flashbacks, all that stuff. In context, Citizen Kane was, you know, huge. Similar to, you could even say the same thing about The Matrix. You know, young kids could go back and watch The Matrix and think like, yeah, that was fine. I don't get the, you know, but The Matrix introduced bullet time and then everybody did that, you know. So now when you go back to The Matrix, it doesn't seem original anymore. It doesn't seem unique.
It seems like The Matrix is parodying the first place you saw bullet time.
Right.
Which, in fact, they were parodying The Matrix, or paying homage at least.
So that's where the context is really important. Same thing goes for video games. You know, having that context, now it's not just this video game existing in a void. It's this video game existing because of this, or because of this, or because, you know, all of these things.
And the example I always give on this podcast, I think I might even mentioned it on our episode. I don't remember anymore. I don't remember half the crap I say. But the fact that, you know, Castlevania 2, Simon's Quest, super forward-thinking game, did not execute it well. If you play it, even back then, it wasn't very good. Well, it was polarizing back then. It's, right. I would say, even more polarizing now. But it was an open-world game with a day and night cycle, something that you would see now, and it's considered the norm, but back then it was something crazy. I actually was listening to an episode of Retronauts talking about Breath of the Wild today, and Breath of the Wild kind of had a similar impact that the original Legend of Zelda did, where the original Legend of Zelda was such a groundbreaking game for the adventure genre, just for video games altogether, because up until that point, you didn't have a game that was that would span the world that it did. It didn't create that fully fleshed out world. It was a game that did not hold the player's hand, but at the same time kept the players feeling like they had this forward progress, this constant momentum. And it created a culture, once again, to add contextual preservation to this, it created a culture around the game, because they talk about on the episode how if you found like kids in school would all be playing Zelda at homes and come to school the next day and share each other's maps. Be like, oh, you found a secret over in this corner. I found a secret over on this screen. You found a secret on that screen. And then they could compare and contrast, and they would end up filling out the map together. And that's a big thing. That's not something you're going to get by playing the cartridge and preserving the cartridge. That's not something you're going to get by watching someone else play it who already knows it. Or doesn't know it. Like they don't have that, because now we could just look up the walkthrough online and figure out where we needed to go because we're too lazy to figure it out on our own, which that would be me. But like that type of preservation, and the only way that type of contextual preservation is going to happen is through kind of like there's a list of the Video Game Foundation lists are like an ecosystem, like a group of people all working together for video game preservation, the ecosystem of video game history. And the only way you're going to get that portion of contextual preservation within that ecosystem would be with creators and players documenting their experiences. That's where YouTube comes in. That's where podcasts like myself. I'm not saying that to toot my own horn. I don't consider myself a video game historian. I'm a video game history enthusiast. But I'm not going around interviewing game developers. I take other people's research and make myself look smart by reciting it. So it's not, but I am part of that ecosystem. And there's other people, tons of other people part of that ecosystem who are documenting, their experiences. You actually mentioned to me when we were emailing back and forth before this, when you complimented me on the Shadow of the Colossus episode. Thank you very much for that, by the way. And how Andrew and I were talking about the urban legend of the 17th Colossus, and how that wasn't, it was just going around. It was all, that's all contextual stuff. Like that's something that if you just played the game, you would not know anything about, unless people preserved all those forum posts, which I think they have. I think they're on archive.org or something like that.
Right.
But contextual preservation is super important for those reasons, because there's a lot of great stories that you would not get otherwise.
And Andrew even mentioned how it affected the remake on PS4, how they added that little tiny Easter egg that would make absolutely no sense if that's the first version of Shadow of the Colossus and that's the first time you've ever heard of it is playing the remake. You would probably never discover that Easter egg or even understand what it came from.
I agree. Is there anything else that you would want to talk about before we move on to the ecosystem? Like, I want to dive in more to the ecosystem that the Video Game History Foundation lists on their website. But is there any other thing you want to bring up in terms of the three pillars of preservation? Once again, for just to recap, since we've talked about them a lot, but just to recap for everyone listening, physical, digital, and contextual preservation. And like we said, physical is the cartridges, the consoles, digital is emulation. It's getting digital versions of the original stuff. And then contextual is everything else in between, a combination of physical and digital. It is the magazines from back then. It is copies of the court documents from when Nintendo got sued by Universal for Donkey Kong. It is the video of the Senate hearings for the ESRB that led to the creation of the ESRB in the 90s when it's talking about video game violence with Mortal Kombat and I just mentioned before Night Trap and stuff like that. Like that, the contextual preservation is all of that.
Television commercials, the urban legends, all of that.
Is there anything, like, I feel like I just listed a whole bunch, so I hope I didn't take all of your answers, but if I did, I apologize. But is there anything else you would want to add to any of those three pillars of video game preservation?
No, I don't think so. I guess the main thing I would say is that we can't really rely on the big companies to do this themselves, to preserve this themselves, because I know that's what, you know, most people would just assume, like, well, Nintendo will take care of Mario and Sega will take care of Sonic and so on, but they are only going to worry about the characters and the games and the worlds that make them money. They're not going to care about, they're not going to care about the B tier, C tier, D tier stuff. And I know that probably creates more questions from some people, like, why would you care if it's not the upper echelon stuff? But we learn from our mistakes, you know. That's so being able to access old games, even if they're terrible, is something that I think is extremely important, or else we're doomed to repeat them, as you know, as they say.
And even just kind of just talking about stuff that would not have gotten anything, or not have gotten any attention by the big guns, by the big companies, by whoever. You might have seen this, because the Game History Foundation retweeted it a bunch, but did you see the article from a librarian named Phil Salvador about Sim Refinery?
Oh, yeah. I was just hearing about that. Yeah.
So for everyone knows the Sim games, and obviously Sim City, Sim City 2000, Sim Railroad, Sim, you know, like for any Sim you could think of. Sim Ants. Yeah. There's all these different Sim games. Well, there was a game that was never, I don't think it was released commercially, called Sim Refinery, and it was developed by, by Maxis, the company that made SimCity and made SimAnts and made all these games that we love. It was developed by them, but for oil corporations. It was developed for businesses as a method of basically
training
simulation. I could think of it. It's in the fucking name. It's Sim. It's I'm so dumb. It was a method for businesses to simulate what their business would do in different areas. And, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs. I didn't read the full article, but if for those who are interested, the guy's name is Phil Salvador. You can find him on Twitter at it's the Shadesy. So at ITSTHESHADSY at it's the Shadesy. You can follow him on there, and it's his pinned tweet right now. He has a website called theobscuratory.com, and that's where the full article is. And it's long, like it's a long article about it. And he's, oh my gosh, it's got an index and everything. Like, this thing is in depth. But that type of stuff, like, that's kind of fascinating to think that Maxis had a whole division dedicated to just simulations for other businesses, not for games. It's a game, but it was a game with the purpose for other businesses to use for their business. They were contracted out to do it, which is kind of crazy to think about. And that's something that you would have never known. And that's a game that's kind of lost, that would have been lost to history if this guy Phil had not done all the digging and all the work to track down developers and find the original source code and everything.
Exactly. And I believe we were talking off mic before we'd started, talking about an episode of a docuseries on Netflix called Screenland. Mm-hmm. And it shows the Video Game History Foundation traveling to North Dakota to preserve a copy of Where in North Dakota is Carmen Sandiego? Because
where in Dakota is Carmen? It doesn't really roll off the tongue that well.
Similar thing. It was contracted for North Dakota, like, schools.
That's so crazy.
Learn more about their state. That, you know, there were limited copies, and same thing, lost to time if the Video Game History Foundation didn't get involved.
So with all that said, with the three pillars of physical, digital, and contextual preservation, what can we do, and what is the existing community doing? Well, there's a bunch of different parts. According to the Video Game History Foundation, what their goal is they want to create a thriving ecosystem of video game history between collectors, creators, historians, institutions, players, and students. I kind of fall into two of these already, collectors and I'm a collector and a creator. Institutions would be schools. So hopefully schools teaching like some type of video game history preservation or video game history courses, which, I mean, there's already film history courses, so it's not far-fetched to think that they'll eventually add something for video game history. For historians, people like Frank Cifaldi, people actually like you, Dexter, because you, I know you had the Kickstarter that didn't, unfortunately did not meet its goal, but I know your plans are not done with that yet. You're planning, you have other plans moving forward with it, but you had a Kickstarter for a video game history children's book. And then players, that's everyone. Everyone who listens to this, I would assume you're a player if you're listening to this podcast. And then students, that was the only one I was kind of fuzzy with. We were talking off mic about it, where it's just kind of like, isn't that, you made the comment that isn't that just everyone, like they're students of video game history, or maybe they're just a student at a university. I don't know. I thought that was kind of an odd thing, but yeah. So those are the six different things that the video game, the six different parts that the Video Game History Foundation lists as an ecosystem they're striving for. What do you feel like you have anything to add to that? Is there anything you want to expand upon with those?
No, I think that pretty much nails the whole gamut. Yeah, I would say just because, you know, same thing with you or I, just because you may not be a programmer, maybe this inspires you to become a programmer, mm-hmm. Or a developer or a designer or anything like that. But even if that's not in your cards, you know, there are so many ways you can get involved. There's so many ways that you can help. Doing the research, consuming the research, all that stuff, the information, being a part of the community, sharing stories, all of those things can help and just like help the whole thing grow, snowball into something that can be helpful. So just because you don't think that you're contributing, because I would still say that I feel like you, Josh, are contributing more than you are letting on with this podcast. You know, even if he doesn't feel like you're contributing anything, if you're involved, if you're having a conversation, I guess that's the biggest thing I want to take away from this, is just to get grand and philosophical on you. Art requires conversation. For something to be, you know, respected or viewed as art, it requires people to talk about it and to have their opinions. So I'll just kind of hit you with that philosophical bomb that, you know, these conversations have to be had for this to be, you know, worth a damn, you know,
to be taken seriously. Any art, anything that's considered quote unquote high art, which is generally the argument that we referenced before of like, are video games art? There's, right. I would say that less and less people are thinking it's not considered quote unquote high art, but it is still something that is still a negative stigma against it. But you're right, because with any bit of high art, if you're not having a serious conversation about it, you're not taking it seriously. Right. And obviously in the grand scheme of life, you don't need art technically to survive, but expression is such a core component of good mental health. And whether you express yourself by intaking media, by consuming media, because that becomes part of who you are, you're able to find an outlet, you're able to relate to this media in some way, shape, or form, and whether that's a video game or otherwise, it is like, while media and entertainment is not strictly like, you can survive off of food and water and you can cut out entertainment is what I'm trying to say. You know what I mean? Like, it's not part of the basic building blocks of life, but it is important nonetheless, because entertainment is there for your mental health. Whether it, I mean, you can make the argument now we're a little bit too overstimulated with entertainment, but it's a good problem to have in a weird way.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with that, but I agree with you. Like, it's like, to be considered art has to be something that that's taken seriously by the community that enjoys it, that participates in it. And I would say probably the high watermark is even when people who don't play video games can recognize their artistic merits. That's when I feel like a medium has made it to yeah. that level. I don't know if I've told the story before, but so my wife and I were definitely kind of like different people. I think I joked about on the episode with her that we did on Stardew Valley, but she's not into games. Like, I'm so deep into this and she's just not. And I had her sit down and play Journey for the first time a couple of years ago, like when we first started dating, and she played it all the way through, and it was definitely I don't think it hit her as much as it hit me, but she actually played through and saw the artistic merit with it. And same when we did our Stardew Valley thing, like that was something where she played that for 80 hours, and that's like, she doesn't play games. She played that for 80 hours. It's crazy to think about. So it's when stuff like that happens, when even if someone who's not that much of a fan of the medium and they can look at it and still find enjoyment out of it, even if they're not looking at it being like, oh my God, this was a groundbreaking experience. It's, you know, this is something that spoke to me. It could just be they logged 80 hours into it. My opinion, you made it. You know, that like, first, my wife doesn't play video games and she logged 80 hours into Stardew Valley. There's something to the medium,
right?
To say the least. Is there anything else that you would want to mention before I move on to the final point I wanted to make?
I don't think so. I just have some, like I said, I've kind of got a list of stuff that people can check out if they are interested in learning more about some of this stuff.
That's perfect then, because my final point is, what is being done now? What currently exists? What resources are available? One of the things that the Video Game History Foundation talks about is that you can't really go to a library for this. There's not a lot of books on video game history at the library. But with that said, there are a lot of resources available online, whether it is, and it's usually done by just enthusiasts, people who have to do a bunch of research. I mentioned Phil Salvador before from the Obscuratory with his Sim Refinery, stuff like that. Like, there's people who are doing this kind of work every single day, and you can find it all over YouTube. You can find it all over the internet. What were some of the plugs you want to mention before I go through some kind of my shout outs?
Yeah, we've mentioned them quite a bit. The Video Game History Foundation, they're an excellent resource. They have a lot of that, you know, they are striving to have that kind of location where people can find information as like research for future, you know, projects and whatnot. There's the Retronauts. I know we've referenced them a few times as well.
I reference them all the time. All the time. I love that podcast.
Great resource. And a couple of books. Game Over, How Nintendo Conquered the World. That was a huge... I read that book probably 10 years ago now, but that's a really great book. Console Wars is a great book. I know that it's a little bit controversial in the sense that people aren't really hip on the historical fiction part of it, because it's kind of formatted as a story, as a novel.
He editorializes a little bit of it from my understanding.
Right. It makes it more fun and palatable, but I can understand.
Is that the right word? Sorry, was that the right word, editorializing? Like, yeah. Where you kind of... Okay, I want to make sure I used it right. For some reason in my head, I'm like, I hope I said that right. Sorry, continue.
he did all of his research and everything. He did all of his interviews, but then he just kind of formatted all of his research into a dramatic storytelling from the actual people's perspective.
Yeah.
So he like put words in their mouth that were, you know, conversational that necessarily weren't said. But you can also check out, they just made a documentary based on the
CBS book. All Access, I think, right?
Yes. Yep. So they kind of boil it down. So if you don't want to read a whole book and you just want to watch an hour and a half documentary, I don't even know if it's a full hour and a half. You can go.
I don't have CBS All Access. I would love to, but I don't want to spend money on it right now.
I think I spent $5 for a month.
Okay, then maybe I'll do that. I'll spend $5 to watch it.
That's what I was like. I'll spend $5 for Console Wars. Supposedly they're making an actual like dramatic movie with actors and whatnot. Seth Rogen is supposed to be producing.
Yes, I remember seeing that like years ago. He picked that up, I think.
Yeah, so that's supposedly still in the works. I would also like to plug Not for Resale, the documentary produced by...
It is a fantastic documentary.
Pat the NES Punk goes into, you know, a lot of this physical and digital conversation about the state of game stores and whatnot. A documentary I mentioned on the last podcast I was on, Reformat the Planet. We didn't talk about it necessarily on here, but kind of how preservation affects some periphery cultures. So in this case of Reformat the Planet, chiptune music, and how they use actual hardware, Game Boys and whatnot, to create this new genre of music. So it's kind of become like this, its own thing, its own art form, but it's using video games. So, and something else similar to that, which was actually introduced to me, I'll give a shout out to Eric Lappy from Let's Get. He introduced me to Digging in the Carts, is a docuseries on YouTube.
Okay.
And each episode focuses on either like one composer, video game music composer, or like a series of like specific, like they have an episode on Uematsu, of course, all of his Final Fantasy scores that he did, Shimamura. They talk about Sunsoft and their like heavy bass music, but it's really fun talking about the different techniques for composing music for old video games.
It was done by Red Bull too.
Yes. Yeah.
That's so weird. I mean, it's cool, but that's so strange. It's interesting. Sorry, go on. That's so fascinating to me.
And it's probably the most easily digestible thing I'm suggesting here, because they're just these little bite-size episodes. I think each episode's like 10, 15 minutes long. So it's a nice little, and if I like chiptune music as well. And the last one on here, kind of, if you were interested in my comic idea as far as using comics to contextually preserve video game history, there is a graphic novel that does exist that is completed by the author and artist Box Brown is the author's name.
Okay.
And the book is called Tetris, or Tetris, the Games People Play. And similar to the way Console Wars, the book is the story of Sega versus Nintendo in the 90s. This graphic novel is about how Tetris came to be, how it came from Russia. And there's a really interesting story behind that,
yes,
as well, as far
is.
As how Nintendo ended up getting the rights to it and how they didn't at first. And then they did. Like, it's pretty fascinating.
The gaming historian does an excellent video on that. I think you're friends with Norm, right? Or you
yes.
at least know yep. Norm pretty well. Yeah. The gaming historian, a YouTube channel, check that out too. Cause it's just going to be a lot of lists. So if you guys are interested in this, everything Dexter said, is there anything else though, before is there anything that I cut you off with or anything like that?
No, that sounds right. Yeah, I would have mentioned Norm as well. He's got a whole YouTube channel dedicated to this stuff. Those are just a few breadcrumbs for people to kind of dive into. If this topic interested them at all, those might be some breadcrumbs or threads to follow and join me down at the bottom of this rabbit hole.
With the gaming historian, his at the time of this recording, his most recent episode, he did a whole episode on the Mega Man DOS games, which were the Mega Man games released for the PC in the 90s, which were not good ports, but they were something. And he actually goes into, like, I think he talks to the developer too, which is kind of cool. For me, some things I like to, I mean, these aren't my plugs, obviously. These are just things that I think are really cool with game history and game preservation. I posted one on Instagram earlier this week. It's called Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America by Jeff Ryan. Really good book. It goes in, it really breaks down how Nintendo got their foothold into the US. And it's super fascinating how, you know, they had a game come over here to rate called Radar Scope. It didn't sell well. So it was either scrap all those arcade cabinets or find some way to convert them. And so they assigned a young unknown artist at Nintendo named Shigeru Miyamoto to create Donkey Kong from that. That's probably your book, isn't it?
Yes, that's. It doesn't go into all the nitty gritty details like that.
Yeah, it's a kid's book, so
it's a kid's book. But yeah, that's the story. Is that help? We need a new game to replace Radar Scope, and that's where Miyamoto steps in, and he doesn't just give them a replacement game. You know, he kind of not only is he doing this in a pinch, you know, with a limited amount of time, he's revolutionizing, you know, the way we think of video games and what we expect from video games.
I could go on a whole thing about how cool that part is, how cool that story is, but I won't. Pat the NES Punk, we mentioned him a couple times before. He has a great series of books called the Nintendo Ultimate Guides, and it's the NES Ultimate Guide and it's the Super Nintendo Ultimate Guide. He doesn't have them for any other consoles just yet. I know he was planning on doing others. I don't know if that's going to come to fruition because
he's working on N64 right now.
He's working on N64 because these books are a lot of work. It's documenting every single North American release and some of the Japanese and PAL releases of these various consoles of Nintendo and Super Nintendo. And it gives a little review of every single one. It includes screenshots of those games, and it gives some fond memories of that one of his friends or collaborators or contributors had of that game. There's 900 games in the NES library or something like that. It's
700, something like that.
And it has all of them on them. It's crazy. It's a really good book if you want to just like flip through it and be like, what is this game about? And it gives you a little bit of a guide to it.
Yeah. And I'd be remiss also to not bring up our mutual friend. Speaking of North American releases, and I know no one can see, but I'm wearing a Famicorner shirt. Our mutual friend Game Dave, he has a show on YouTube, also Famicorner, where he does get into the Japanese releases and talks about that as well. So he's got and great sense of humor, great, you know, very high quality videos.
Good for kids too, by the way. I know my podcast generally isn't. I swear a little bit too much on mine, but his content for those who have sensitive ears around them, it is very family friendly. I know we've been mentioning so many. This is a long list. This is probably getting annoying, but there's just so many. I love it. There is it's a bit more on the technical side, but there's a book called I Am Error, and it is a book that breaks down. It's almost a college textbook. The way it's written as an educational textbook of the technical architecture of the Nintendo Entertainment System and how, graphics were passed back and forth from the GPU to the CPU and so on. Well, not the CPU. It was the GPU and I forget what the term for their CPU was. It wasn't really much of a CPU on that thing. But in any case, I think it's a GPU and a PPU. I forget. There's a bunch of weird terms for it. But it goes into the super, super technical detail. And it kind of gives you an idea of why certain, like a lot of the technical limitations of the Nintendo and how developers had to work around those technical limitations in order to put games on the system, like the limitations of the color palette, how many sprites could be on the screen at the same time, stuff like that. A really cool series where this kind of lends itself to the contextual preservation we mentioned, Legends of Localization. Now, it's a website you can go to. And what Legends of Localization does, they have books. I actually have one of the books with me. But what Legends of Localization does is that it is a guy named Clyde Mandolin who does translations. He's a localizer who takes games in Japanese and localizes them to English. And there's a big difference between translation and localization. Translation is just the one-to-one. This is what it is in Japanese. Let's just translate it directly to English. Localization is let's take those things in Japanese and make it more palatable to whichever market the game is being released in. Now, in America, localization was pretty bad during the NES days because it was, one, it was so new, and two, Japan was kind of this big, scary thing to Americans at the time. So that's why if you look at old NES games, it's not like Sasuke and I don't know why I'm going Naruto on this. It's not like there was Naruto on the NES, but it's not like it would be Sasuke and Kagome or something like that. It would just be Bob and Jill.
Yeah.
And it just, it's, they would just drop the Japanese names because Japan was scary back just then.
Compare to American. The box art between the two.
Oh yeah. And the box arts. And he has books though on, he has two books out now. One is on the original Legend of Zelda, and he breaks down the translation differences and how, like, this is what it says in Japan, literally, and this is how it was translated. They probably translated it this way for A, B, and C reasons. And they also, he also talks about, or he also shares the sound clips, like all the differences between the sound files between that, because that is part of the localization. And his second book, which is a lot more in depth, is on Earthbound, which that has a lot more text than the original Legend of Zelda. So that's going to be a lot longer. Hardcore Gaming 101 is a great website that has a lot of good video game history stuff. Patrick Hickey Jr., like I mentioned before, and I interviewed him before, his series, The Minds Behind the Games. And other than that, just there's a lot of great YouTube channels. Ahoy is a good YouTube channel. They do really good retrospectives on video games. I'm a personal fan of their Monkey Island retrospective. If you're looking for other podcasts, Retronauts, of course, Super Mercado Bros, they do a really good job of breaking down on a musical technical level, like what video game composers are doing. And they speak in musician terms. I'm not a musician, so it goes a little bit over my head, but I still enjoy it enough to listen through the whole thing. But anyway, sorry, I could keep on going, but I'll stop it there. I think the big ones for me are Legends of Localization is fantastic. Patrick Hickey Jr., fantastic. And then, of course, Hardcore Gaming 101 and Retronauts. Those are my big ones.
Yeah, there's lots of them out there. And I'm sure that there's plenty that I'm forgetting as well.
There's just so much. I mean, I think that's a good spot to wrap up the episode with. That's just our two experiences of video game preservation done on the internet, whether it's through YouTube documentaries and YouTube channels or it's through various books. You mentioned the Not for Resale documentary. There are a handful of documentaries out. I mean, hell, even if you're going with contextual, King of Kong, yes. Which I've never watched, but I know it's the story of, what's Billy's last name?
Mitchell.
That's what it was. Billy Mitchell, the former world record holder of Donkey Kong. And it is about it's a competition between him and this young upstart. Well, I don't know how young he is, but it's a competition between him and a newcomer. And it's a big contextual bit of preservation talking about the arcade scene.
You have to check that out. I'm in a similar scenario where my wife is not nearly as interested in video games as I am. She got hooked on that documentary.
Really?
Yeah. She thought it was so fascinating. And I also, it's close to my heart as well, because a lot of it takes place at the Fun Spot Arcade, which I went there on summers growing up. So it was nice to see that familiar location to me.
For those who are curious, King of Kong is on Hulu for the subscription. So let me just make sure it's not... It might be, you might need a Starz subscription, because now that I see it, it says Hulu, Sling, Starz, and Amazon Prime. And whenever I see Starz mixed in with Hulu and Prime, it generally means you need a Starz subscription. Generally. It looks like someone uploaded the full thing to YouTube, though. So there you go.
It might be. Yeah, it might be on like that.
I see an
like
hour and 22 video on YouTube right now. That's wild. But anyway. That will wrap it up for this episode of Still Loading. I hope you enjoyed it. This was more of a discussion about video game preservation and kind of like a discussion awareness type of thing. We like Dexter, I know you're a big fan of video game history, so I'm really happy you agreed to come on to this episode for this topic. This was a lot of fun. I don't have a lot of friends in my area who are passionate about video game history. So I'm very happy that I have met someone who is as passionate as I am, that I can actually have a conversation with and just kind of go back and forth on it. So thank you so much for joining me on this episode.
Yeah, same. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, I'm in a similar boat. I'm usually the quote unquote video game guy in conversations with friends. So it's nice to have kind of an equal banter about video game history and whatnot. And if there are other folks out there that would like to chat as well. I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter. So, you know, beyond the history stuff, I do artwork. Most of it's related to video game history in some way. And yes, I did recently, last month, I had the Kickstarter for children's books about video game history. And I would like to keep that going. I have a publishing line called Bite-Sized Books, spelled B-Y-T-E hyphen sized books. And that's kind of the banner I'd like this to be under. I am, Game Dave and I are in talks about continuing the kids book thing together. And it's something I'm really passionate about, you know, contextual preservation, putting, doing my part as far as like I do art and design and bringing that and helping preserve video game history and telling these stories, because the next generation is the one that's going to keep this stuff going. And if, you know, if they don't care about it, it might go away. You know, think about all the Elvis memorabilia that used to be on QVC and stuff late at night when we were kids. And now all of that stuff, people can't give it away because nobody knows who Elvis is anymore. I don't want that happen to video games.
That's so crazy. I do think it is video games will last longer, mainly because a lot of the mainstays from the old generations are still around. There's still games coming out. There was a new Pac-Man game that came out somewhat recently, and you know what I mean? Like I think it's going to last a while, but you're right. Like, without video game preservation, and whether that is the documenting of, you know, interviews and all this other stuff with developers and keeping the cartridges and, you know, getting the source code, or it's just talking about experiences, because experiences are something that is relatable to everybody. When I stream on Twitch, there's a couple of young kids who are younger than me, at least over 10 years younger than me, who have talked to me about wanting to get into collecting. And that's awesome. That was not my intention. I just think, you know, it's one of those things, like, if you share your passion, people respond to passion. And as long as obviously you're pleasant about it, but people respond to passion. So it is important. That's how you keep this thing going.
Absolutely.
So is there anything you would want for any personal plugs for yourself? Oh, wait, you did that already, right?
Yeah. Okay. Check me out on Instagram. Check me out on Twitter. It's just, you know, search my name, Dexter Morrill. 2 R's, 2 L's. I share stuff there. My artwork, video game history stuff. So
I'll make sure to tag you in the social media post for this as well, for when this episode goes live. So that way people can find you through that as well.
Yeah, I've got my website as well. Same thing, dexter-morrill.com. So
I'll include that in the show notes as well, just so people can find it. So as usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. You can reach out to me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of different ways. You can give it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps the show get more exposure so more people can find it. That would actually be probably the most beneficial, in all honesty. Like, normally I would say, give me money on Patreon, but in all honesty, 5-star reviews are fantastic. So if you like the show, please consider doing that. You can also support the show on Patreon, like I mentioned before, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. If you want to help, even just $1 a month will help grow the show. Check out the Podbeard Network, the network I'm a part of. And finally, the most important shout out/plug is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at children's hospitals. So if you want to check them out, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that is all my plugs. Dexter, thank you so much again for joining me. This was a super fun chat. I hope you all enjoyed the episode as much as I did recording it. I love talking about video game history, if you couldn't tell. So, Dexter, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
So that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you all next time.